The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. My name is Jeremiah Jacques, and I'll be guest hosting today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. And the program today is coming to you from the KPCG studios here in Edmond, Oklahoma. Well, I'd like to start off the show today talking about just how tiny the modern world has become. Before the year 1850, if you wanted to send a message from, let's say, Kansas City to Tokyo, that would have taken almost 2 months to get the message sent. Today, it takes a few seconds to send that same message the same distance. Before the year 1900, a trip from Philadelphia to Madrid would have taken at least 10 days. Today, it takes 8 hours. And then think about a culture that would have been entirely unknown to the average American in the year 1900 or at any time before that. Something like the Vietnamese kin, for example. Well, today that culture has its own section in American grocery stores, and it has representatives in most Western schools, universities, and office complexes. One more quick example. 30 years ago, if you wanted to translate a 10-page document into another language, it would have taken hours and hours of tedious labor, even for just a rough rendering. It would have been days and days of work. Today, though, you can use computer software to render it almost instantly. It'll have some problems and mistakes, but you'll know the meaning of the document. So, for thousands of years of human history, planet Earth was vast and unknowable. But now, just in the last few decades, it has effectively been shrunk. Globalization, technological advancement, the knowledge explosion, language trends, all of these things are homogenizing the planet and shrinking it. These things are blending the world's people into an ever more interconnected global community. And all of this integration between nations and cultures is utterly unprecedented. So what does it mean to be living in a world that is shrinking so quickly? What will be the effects of smashing the geographic barriers and the linguistic barriers that have segregated people into distinct cultures for so many centuries? Many believe that our shrunk, interconnected, technology-saturated environment is ushering in a new age of peace among the peoples and nations. And there is some evidence that seems to support that view. But other factors point to a very different and very sobering outcome. On today's Trumpet Daily, we will talk about these questions, and we'll also talk about what Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong said on this topic. And we'll just take a look at what it means to be living on this incredible shrinking planet. A couple of years ago, I was digging into some of these questions and researching specifically the topic of language and just how some languages are growing more and more prominent, more and more broadly spoken, while other languages are dying off. And I was here in Edmond, Oklahoma, so I thought I would see which languages were spoken in Oklahoma. And one of them that came up on one of the lists that I saw was Wichita, the Wichita language, spoken, of course, by the Wichita Amerindians or Native Americans. And I looked into it a little bit more and found out that there was only one person left who spoke Wichita, a woman named Doris McLemore. Well, I dug around a little bit, and I was actually able to find her phone number. She was living in Anadarko, Oklahoma. So I called her up, and we spoke for about 45 minutes or more about the Wichita language and about what it was like for her to be the very last person on Earth that spoke it. That was on July 10th, 2014, when I spoke with her. She was 87 years old at that time, and she said, quote, "Never, ever did I expect to be the last speaker of the Wichita language," end quote. She spoke quite a bit of Wichita for me, just so I could sort of get a feel for how the language sounded. And it's sort of a halting stream of consonants and vowels broken by abrupt stoppages of air in the back of the throat. Glottal stops, they're called. And Wichita was around for a long, long time. Linguists say that evolving forms of it were spoken across pretty big stretches of North America for millennia, so going back thousands of years. During that interview, Mrs. McLemore told me that her favorite Wichita word was Edkuulolot, which is the word for whippoorwill, the bird. And I'm sure that I'm butchering that pronunciation, but it was something close to that. And she told me that she clearly remembered a time when Wichita was spoken by everyone around her, her entire community there in Anadarko. But little by little over the years, generation by generation, Wichita was replaced by English. And last year, on August 30th of 2016, Mrs. McLemore died. And her death actually made the papers here in Oklahoma because with her, the Wichita language that had been spoken for thousands of years by thousands and thousands of people also died. There are still a handful of linguists and members of the Wichita tribe who continue to study some of the basics of the language. But now that the last fluent speaker is dead, it's really just a cultural curiosity. It's a relic of a bygone era. And really, on this incredible shrinking planet, the death of languages is quite common. When Wichita went extinct on August 30th last year, it joined a quickly growing number of languages that die each year. In the last 5 years alone, the world has lost the Dungaloo language in Australia. We've lost the Livonian language in Latvia, Nuchatlat in Canada, Mandan in North Dakota here in the U.S., and about 150 other languages. The rate of language death is accelerating every year, and it's now happening at an unprecedented pace. Mark Pagel is a biologist specializing in languages, and in a recent interview with NPR, he said, quote, "Something like 30 to 50 languages per year go extinct," end quote. As a result of so many languages dying, more than half of the world's people today speak just 10 common languages. And if current trends persist, Mr. Pagel says, quote, "It's virtually inevitable that there will be a single language on Earth," end quote. And all indications are that if the current trends are to persist, English would become that one language. Up until pretty recently, in nations where English is not natively spoken, proficiency in it was sort of a marker of the elite. But now proficiency in English is a basic requirement for so many people in the workforce. By a wide margin, English is the world's most commonly studied foreign tongue. It is the lingua franca of the modern era, and more than 2 billion people actually speak English daily. That's almost 1 in 3 human beings. The American entrepreneur Jay Walker recently said, quote, "English is the world's second language. Your native language is your life, but with English you can become part of a wider conversation, a global conversation. The world has other universal languages. Mathematics is the language of science. Music is the language of emotions. And now English is becoming the language of problem solving. Not because America is pushing it, but because the world is pulling it," end quote. So that is the trend with language on this incredible shrinking planet. The small ones are rapidly dying, and the large ones, especially English, are becoming more and more universal. It reminds me of that passage in the book of Matthew that says something like, "For whosoever has, to him shall be given even more. But whoever has not, from him shall be taken away even what he has." That's what's been happening with languages, especially over the last couple of hundred years. And meanwhile, mankind is in the midst of what can only be called an explosion of knowledge and technology, and its growth is exponential. Think about this. In the year 1903, Wilbur and Orville Wright flew an airplane very clumsily for about 59 seconds. 4 decades later, incredibly nimble Japanese warplanes bombed Pearl Harbor. And then less than 30 years after that, the United States landed men on the moon and then brought them back home. So mankind went from awkwardly gliding a few feet off the ground for less than a minute to shooting manned rockets to the moon and back, all within one human lifetime. Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong actually lived through that exact human lifetime. He was born a little bit before the Wright brothers made their maiden flight there, and then he lived to see all of the missions to the moon, too. And he didn't take that for granted. He knew that it was unusual. In the author's statement of his book, Mystery of the Ages, Mr. Armstrong wrote, quote, "I have lived through the horse and buggy age, the automobile and industrial age, the air age, the nuclear age, and now into the space age. I've seen America live through the agrarian age when farmers walked behind their horse-drawn plows singing happily, and into the urban age." End quote. So it's clear that Mr. Armstrong knew that the technological explosion that he was living through was unique in human history. He understood that most generations do not live through advancement and technological development on a scale even approaching what he had witnessed. And in the time since the lunar landings, the speed of the technological advancement has only accelerated. Eric Schmidt, who is executive chairman of Google's parent company, recently said, "Mankind now creates as much information in 2 days as humans did from the dawn of civilization up until 2003. So every 2 days, that's astounding. It's hard to argue with the math there when you consider things like the fact that YouTube alone uploads more than 400 hours of video every single minute. The smartphone in your pocket has far more processing power than any computer that was aboard the Apollo 11 spacecraft that brought those people to the moon. Your phone is also a better communication tool than anything President Reagan had. And it gives you access to more information than President Bill Clinton could access. Smartphones are insanely powerful, and they're not just for the affluent. More than 1 in 4 human beings on the planet now owns one. In Albania, it's not uncommon to see a person riding on a donkey while speaking on an iPhone. In India, some beggars take breaks from their solicitations to make calls on their Android device. And in the popular revolutions that were sweeping across the Arab world over the last few years, the Arab Spring, smartphones played a central role in informing people and in coordinating all of those history-altering uprisings. So these are incredibly powerful pieces of technology. They give us access to more information than the world's most powerful man had just 20 years ago. And we all just walk around with them like it's normal. And for those who do not yet speak a common language, technology has also given us numerous culture-bridging options. Google Translate has gotten quite good in the last few years. There's also programs like I'm Translator, Prompt, Bing Translator, and other services that can provide crude translations among dozens of languages in just a few seconds for free. As I mentioned, the translations are far from perfect, but even professional translators often use these as first drafts. And if you're just talking about basic sentences, they do a pretty good job, even these free services. These and dozens of other new technologies are sort of like trampolines beside the language barrier. They let millions of people hop over that barrier every day. Scientists are also rapidly developing artificial intelligence, medical technology, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, data science, and an innumerable list of other technologies. More than 50 years ago, the Danish physicist Niels Bohr said, quote, "Technology has advanced more in the last 30 years than in the previous 2000. The exponential increase in advancement will only continue." End quote. And with each passing year, those words by Dr. Bohr there become more and more true. So when you add these two things together, the explosion of knowledge and technology, and then what's simultaneously happening with the extinction of small languages and the spread of English and the other large languages, it's plain to see that the world today is becoming tiny. And what may be the most noteworthy result of the shrinking world is that it has resulted in mass intercultural collaboration. So that just means bringing together cultures, all kinds of different cultures, on a large scale to collaborate on various projects. In the pre-industrial world, it was not altogether unheard of for large numbers of people from different cultures to work together on big projects, but such instances were pretty rare. And also the definition of what you might call large numbers has evolved a lot over time. I'll just quickly go through a couple of the pre-industrial era examples of mass intercultural collaboration. One of the earliest of these was the first temple in Jerusalem. That was built in the 10th century BC by an unusually large group of Phoenicians and Israelites. More than 150,000 people altogether came together and worked under King Solomon to build that. And then in the 1600s AD, about 20,000 craftsmen from several different cultures came together to build the Taj Mahal in India. There were Indians, of course, but also craftsmen from Persia, from the Ottoman Empire, from Europe, all of them pooling their efforts together to build the Taj Mahal. And then once you got into the industrial age, there was the Panama Canal. That was done in the early 1900s, and there were about 70,000 men from the West Indies, from Panama, from the United States, Italy, and Spain, all coming together under U.S. leadership to accomplish that astounding feat of engineering. So those are some pretty big numbers, 20,000 men, 70,000 men, and even 150,000. But in the internet age, these kinds of numbers of collaborators are suddenly pretty small. Think about Wikipedia. That's the free online encyclopedia. Wikipedia is the product of collaboration by more than 30 million people. These are researchers and writers and editors from all over the world, and they've produced about 40 million articles so far. Wikipedia, of course, has its problems, but it's becoming a more valuable resource all the time, especially for what you might call neutral topics. And in no other time period would it have been even remotely possible for 30 million people to work together and collaborate on a project like that. Then there's also Duolingo. This is a project launched about 5 years ago, and it has about 110 million people in nations around the globe working to translate the internet into other languages. The users actually do this as they learn another language, and they do it for free. So it's a brilliant business model, really. And it's astounding to think that there are 110 million people, more than the total population of Germany, all working together on the Duolingo project. But even that mind-staggering number pales in comparison to the number of people who have worked together on another internet project called ReCAPTCHA. You've probably seen ReCAPTCHA 1,000 times on all kinds of different sign-up pages across the internet. The purpose is to separate humans from, you know, spam bots. And so a small challenge will pop up just asking you to decipher a picture of words or numbers, or to choose certain objects in a grid of pictures. Those distorted words, though, they're not just random. Every person who enters ReCAPTCHA text is actually helping to digitize old books and newspapers. Google has launched this project to digitize as much of the written word as possible, and for newer publications, computers are able to do it without human assistance. They can recognize and digitize text without any human help. But for anything written more than about 50 years ago, computers are usually only able to recognize about 70% of the words. And nothing short of a real live human being can read those remaining words. So without knowing it, for most of us, every time we type one of those fuzzy words into a ReCAPTCHA field, we are not only verifying to the website that we are a real human being, but we're also helping to digitize an old document. We're helping to make that document available to internet users all around the world. And here's how many people have contributed to this massive online project so far. 750 million. That's more than 1 in 10 of all human beings alive. Put together, all of these collaborators are digitizing the equivalent of 2.5 million books per year. So anyway, the point of all this is just to show that the advancements in technology that we are witnessing are allowing collaboration between all different cultures on levels never before seen and never before possible. It shows that human collaboration has soared to entirely unprecedented heights. So the question is all of this development good or bad? Does it mean mankind is right on the cusp of ushering in a bright new dawn? Or are we edging, gigabyte by gigabyte, invention by invention, nearer to extinction? Well, we'll take a short break right there, and after we're back, we'll discuss the answer to that question. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm, and we'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Jeremiah Jacques standing in today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. This is KPCG-FM. You can listen in online at kpcg.fm, or if you're here in the Edmond, Oklahoma area, tune in at 101.3 on the FM dial. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments our way by emailing td@kpcg.fm. We'd love to hear from you. In the first half of the show, we discussed just how quickly the world is shrinking and how diversity of languages is rapidly shrinking, and also how technology is advancing at totally unprecedented levels, and also how the confluence of those two factors has resulted in mass intercultural collaboration on levels that were never possible before. And for the second half here, I'd like to get into the question of whether this is a positive development or if it means we might be in for trouble. Is all of this advancement, is it good or is it bad? On both sides of this question, there are passionate arguments from leading thinkers. The entrepreneur Naveen Jain believes that technological advances will end up solving all of mankind's ancient problems. He said, quote, "There is not a problem that's large enough that innovation and entrepreneurship can't solve," end quote. The theoretical physicist Freeman Dyson agrees with this assessment. He said, quote, "Technology is a gift of God. After the gift of life, it is perhaps the greatest of God's gifts. It is the mother of civilizations, of arts, and of sciences." End quote. So there's quite a lot of optimism there in both of those statements. But then on the other side of the argument, you have the late President John F. Kennedy, who was one of the key leaders during the Cold War era, and he was very worried about the scientific advancements that he saw mankind making during that time. And during one interview, he said, quote, "I'm sorry to say that there is too much point to the wisecrack that life is extinct on other planets because their scientists were more advanced than ours." End quote. So he was just pointing to a joke there, but it shows that he viewed technological advancements as, you know, possibly posing an existential threat to all of mankind. And Albert Einstein agreed with this. Einstein said that he thought mankind's technological developments would eventually lead to a war so cataclysmic that it would basically reset civilization. Einstein said, quote, "It has become appallingly obvious that our technology has exceeded our humanity. I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones." End quote. So that's a pretty sobering assessment there, both of those last two quotes. But which side is right? For the answer, let's examine the world's first, what you might call, large-scale collaboration. This was more than 4,000 years ago, just two generations after the Great Flood, and Earth's population at this time was exploding with growth. If you look at the records in Genesis 10 and 11, you see that the bulk of the people gathered somewhere in the region of what is now called Iraq. Genesis 11:2 talks about the plains of Shinar, which is in that area that today we call Iraq. And these people began collaborating on a massive project. There were no language barriers hindering their work on this massive project because at this time, everybody on Earth spoke the same language. Verse 1 of Genesis 11 makes that clear. And so this huge single language workforce could have accomplished virtually anything. In fact, there's an assessment made in verses 5 and 6 of the progress of their collaborative work and just how seamlessly they were able to collaborate and how rapidly they were advancing. And it says that this integrated workforce could accomplish anything its people could imagine. That's amazing. It's almost boundless in some ways. God created human minds. He gave them their astounding power, and he knew that with lots of people laboring together, collaborating together, unhindered by language barriers, the Iraqi sky was the limit for what they could accomplish. But God also knew something else. If you look in Genesis 6, verse 5, it says, quote, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." End quote. Those words were written specifically about the people of the world before the flood. But when you take a look at the Genesis 11 account alongside this passage in Genesis 6 and other passages such as Jeremiah 17:9 and 2 Timothy 3:7, then it's plain that that particular aspect of men's hearts did not change after the flood waters receded and after those rivers crawled back into their banks. Mankind's ideas, creativity, and innovations are consistently motivated by a lot of selfishness. And for proof of that, just consider what the project was that this powerful post-flood workforce collaborated on. And remember, they could have accomplished virtually anything. So what did these people pool their resources and put their brilliant minds together to build? A tower. The flood was fresh in their memories. They knew that God had sent that flood on the earlier generations as punishment because the people had chosen to live in rebellion against God and against his law. So the post-flood people, instead of learning from that history that they should be different from the pre-flood people and that they should, you know, learn to obey God and to avoid angering him, instead of that, the lesson that they came away from it with was that In order to continue rebelling, they should build a structure that would place them above the reach of floodwaters in case God decided to send another flood. They reasoned that if they could outclimb any future flood, then they could live their lives as they pleased, do whatever they wanted to, and still avoid the punishment that had come upon those earlier generations. You can read about all of that in Genesis 11, 3 through 4. And the account makes clear that this massive collaboration project was just about as anti-God as any project could be. And it progressed with stunning speed. God knew that this Tower of Babel construction project was only the beginning. Remember there in verse 6, it says, he saw that, quote, nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do, end quote. So God knew that virtually anything a man can imagine, mankind can accomplish. Anything that a scientist or a science fiction author or a child can dream up, you know, radio, cars, airplanes, microwaves, smartphones, email, space travel, anything we can dream up, mankind can apparently eventually bring about if people are able to collaborate on a large enough scale. And then God also knew of one thing that would perpetually be central in man's imagination: weapons. He knew, as our history has proven, that humans would always be collaborating to build ever more destructive weaponry. God has a plan for mankind, and he has a specific time frame for that plan. If you don't know many of the details about this plan, please go to thetrumpet.com and order a copy of Mystery of the Ages, which lays it all out beautifully. But it's clear that God understood at that time, back on the plains of Shinar in modern day Iraq, that if he didn't intervene with that project, then mankind would continue collaborating and would soon develop weapons of mass destruction that could and would wipe humanity out. And he saw that it would interfere with his plan for mankind. It would result in extinction of the species, which would not allow the time required for the time frame of his plan. So the Creator did something ingenious and something utterly original. He abruptly divided the people into separate linguistic groups. And if you try to think about the concept of different languages in a world where only one language had ever existed, you can probably see just how abstract and remarkable and brilliant, really, this idea was. And it presumably just sort of rebooted the language centers in the brains of these various people. And so suddenly, there were multiple languages, maybe dozens or even hundreds of language groups, possibly thousands. We don't know how many. But maybe one of them was an early form of the Wichita language that Mrs. McLemore spoke and that died with her last year. But anyway, suddenly, there were multiple languages. And with the laborers on that project no longer able to communicate with each other, work on the Tower of Babel screeched to a halt. It was never completed. And the groups, divided by their various new languages, ended up scattering all over the planet. Genesis 11, verse 7 through 9 talks about that. And it shows that after these peoples were separated from each other linguistically, they dispersed and became separated from each other geographically. This phenomenon greatly slowed mankind's ability to collaborate, which meant that it also greatly slowed mankind's ability to bring to life the imaginations of his selfish and bellicose heart. So here we are today, 2017, some 4,000 years after the languages were divided, 4 millennia after technological advancement was slowed down so drastically. And today the world is rapidly changing, as we looked at in the first half of the program. Today man is learning to jump over language barriers and to smash those barriers down with technology. We're learning to overcome geographic segregation. Much of the segregation of humanity that God caused at the Tower of Babel is essentially being undone. So does this mean that this is against God's will? Does it mean that people are now kind of outfoxing our Creator? No, it doesn't mean that at all. God knew that the nations would eventually globalize and integrate and collaborate. And in fact, he actually prophesied the dawning of this interconnected, knowledge-saturated age that we now live in. Through the prophet Daniel, God said that at the time of the end, knowledge would be increased. That has primarily a spiritual meaning about the end-time church, but it also is a really apt description of this internet age. And then if you look at 2 Timothy 3, it says, in the last days perilous times shall come, in part because people would be, quote, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. That's verses 1 and 7. And then in Romans 1, God condemns those who become vain in their imaginations, professing themselves to be wise, though they are inventors of evil things. That's in verses 21 through 30. So the modern world, this modern interconnected, knowledge-drenched world, is a fulfillment of these prophecies. The world has come to be as it is in perfect accordance with God's timetable. And then there's another key prophecy that explains that God would permit man's technology to advance enough to bring about those weapons capable of extinguishing all life on earth. Matthew 24, 21 through 22 in the New Living Translation says, quote, "For there will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began, and it will never be so great again. In fact, unless that time of calamity is shortened, not a single person will survive, but it will be shortened for the sake of God's chosen ones." End quote. It really is interesting to me that at the time that Christ spoke that prophecy, destruction of every single person was not possible. Warfare in those days of Roman rule consisted of hand-to-hand combat with swords, spears, and things like that. The closest thing to a weapon of mass destruction at that time was the stone-slinging catapult. Even after another 1,200 years passed, Genghis Khan was still using similar weaponry, bows, arrows, and sabers. With these weapons, his army was able to kill about 1 in 10 human beings alive at the time. Staggering numbers, but still far off from being able to annihilate all human life. By the 15th century, the advent of gunpowder had led to widespread use of guns and cannons. Soon after that came rockets, grenades, and bombs. All of these things greatly increased the efficiency of extinguishing lives. As cold as that sounds, but mankind still couldn't create a war in which not a single person could survive. But now that mankind is reconnected, what is one of the landmark collaborative projects that we have undertaken? It is the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb has changed everything. And there were actually around 130,000 people collaborating on the Manhattan Project and other related projects that brought about the atomic bomb. These people came from many nations and language backgrounds. It couldn't have happened without the theory of relativity posited by the German-born Jew that we quoted earlier, Albert Einstein. And then other Germans such as Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann contributed also. And so did Austrians Lise Meitner and Otto Fritsch. They all contributed to the groundbreaking physics theory that made it possible. Other leading collaborators came from the United States, Hungary, Italy, Poland, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Denmark. It's also interesting to me that the research and production for the bomb occurred in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada. So the working language for this project was English. Not long after the Manhattan Project, mankind moved up from the atomic bomb to develop hydrogen bombs. These fusion-powered bombs are up to 1,000 times more powerful than the fission-powered atomic ones, like those that were dropped on Japan. Today, mankind has at least 15,000 nuclear warheads, and scientists say that only these nuclear weapons, developed just in the last 70 years or so, have the potential to erase all human life from Earth. And this really fulfills that 2,000-year-old prophecy recorded there in Matthew 24. Could another world war happen in which these bombs are detonated? Well, during this age, in which 750 million people can work together on a noble project, and in which innovation and collaboration are just exploding with growth, shouldn't we expect to see rapid progress toward global stability? Instead, in most cases, or in many cases at least, we see the opposite. We see exacerbating instability in Syria, in Iraq, Ukraine, the Korean Peninsula, Israel, parts of Africa and Central America, Mexico, and the South China Sea, and elsewhere. Civilization today has no shortage of flashpoints that could escalate to a thermonuclear level. And that's not the only danger that mankind faces. I've got a quote here from Martin Rees. He is an astronomer who describes himself as a, quote, concerned member of the human race. And in a recent interview, he said, quote, "It's now not just the nuclear threat. In our interconnected world, network breakdowns can cascade globally. Air travel can spread pandemics worldwide within days. And social media can spread panic and rumor literally at the speed of light." End quote. So our collaborations, our technology, our imaginations have not resolved all of our conflicts. In some sobering ways, they've made them worse. Toward the beginning of the show today, we quoted Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, who was really a leading expert on civilization's origins and on its turbulent history and its unstable present in the modern era. We mentioned that he lived through some of the most amazing technological advancements, and he didn't take it for granted. And in his book, Mystery of the Ages, Mr. Armstrong wrote, quote, "Could anything be wrapped in more mystery than this world's civilization? How explain the astonishing paradox, a world of human minds that can send astronauts to the moon and back, produce the marvels of science and technology, transplant human hearts, yet cannot solve simple human problems of family life and group relationships or peace between nations." End quote. The incredible shrinking planet that we are all part of today really is witness to an astonishing paradox, as Mr. Armstrong said. And those questions that he asked there are burning with more relevance now than they ever have been before. So I really encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab there and order a free copy of Mr. Armstrong's book, his magnum opus, really, Mystery of the Ages. It's completely free. And there's a chapter in there called The Mystery of Civilization that can bring you to a deep understanding of what the answers to these questions are. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG FM 101.3 on the FM dial here in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available all around the world by typing kpcg.fm into your internet browser. And please send us your feedback, your questions, and comments. Our email address is td@kpcg.fm. Well, thank you for joining us today, and please tune in and join us again tomorrow when your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury, will be back.